Welcome to the last in this series of Darwin College lectures on the theme of Darwin. I say last with a sort of sob in my throat. I think I said when I started this series that I was as excited about it as a 12-year-old, and it's not for me to say. You'll have your own views, but I found it absolutely fascinating. It's the extraordinary range of ways in which Darwin's insights have developed thought. Obviously, the foundations of biological sciences and the origin and the future of species, not least our own, but also the insights and the influence on our culture, our literature, and our understanding of society. And given this extraordinarily potent set of theoretical insights, we thought the only way we could finish was with a philosopher. The title is The Boundaries of Darwinism, and our speaker is John Dupré, who's Professor of Philosophy of Science at Exeter University. He did his first degree at Oxford, came here for his doctoral research, went on to Stanford and then to Birkbeck before going to Exeter. His political science has been concerned with, among other things, alternatives to determinism and to developing views of science which emphasize the benefits of its disunity and lack of coherence, which makes me think there may be hope for Cambridge University yet. Some idea of his interests come from the title of his books, which include The Human Nature and the Limits of Science, Humans and Other Animals, Darwin's Legacy, What Evolution Means Today, and most recently, Genomes and What to Make of Them. It's a pleasure to introduce John Dupré to speak about the boundaries of Darwinism.
Thank you very much for a kind introduction. Okay, so to start with an overview of what I want to talk about. And I guess the first thing I should say is that I'm really not going to talk much about Darwin, and I'm hoping perhaps that you've heard so much about Darwin that you'll forgive me for talking more about Darwinism than Darwin. And indeed, I'm going to, in certain ways, I want to be somewhat skeptical about the concept of Darwinism, because it seems to me that one of the problems that I've become quite aware of in this celebratory year for Darwin is that Darwin sometimes seems to me to have a status which is quite inappropriate for a scientist, almost as a kind of source of holy writ rather than a source of scientific theory from many years ago. So in a way, what I want to do is defend the notion that Darwin was a real scientist, and therefore we should not expect him to tell us 150 years later what we should think today. When I talk about Darwinism, and here perhaps I'm being a little more generous to a view of Darwin, I'm really not so much talking about what Darwin believed at all, but I'm talking about the point in the set of views that developed in the middle of the last century, which have come to be known as Darwinism, sometimes as neo-Darwinism, and represent the moment in history when Darwin's idea of natural selection caught up in public and scientific acceptance with the idea of evolution. And what I want really to say is that this has itself become a rather dogmatic set of views, and that if we look at some things that are happening in biology now, some quite recent advances in biology, we increasingly see that neo-Darwinism, this kind of canonical view of evolution that, as I say, developed in the middle of the last century, is really becoming an obstacle rather than an aid to scientific progress. So here is roughly speaking what I mean by neo-Darwinism. Probably the absolutely core thesis, natural selection is overwhelmingly the main cause of adaptation, the main explanation for how things come to be so beautifully adapted to their conditions of life. A secondary and almost equally important thesis is that the inheritance of biological characteristics is mediated almost exclusively by nuclear DNA, by the genomes at the center of our cells. And another perhaps more optional thesis, but one that's become very widely discussed, obviously I'm sure you all recognize it as connected with Richard Dawkins, is the idea that genes are the things that natural selection selects. Okay, now, so my object today is to kind of get some sense of the implications for moving beyond Darwinism or neo-Darwinism for our understanding of evolution, and especially, though I won't spend a whole lot of time on this, on human evolution. So just quickly, Darwin as a scientist, just to say some more obvious things about Darwin as part of the history of science, not science today. Darwin wrote 150 years ago, as we all know. He could know nothing about genetics, genomics, and so on and so on. In particular, I want to emphasize one area, and this I will say quite a bit about today, about which he could, by our standards today, know almost nothing, microbiology. Now, I should say Darwin was actually very interested in microbiology, but there just wasn't that much to know. Our ability to understand microbes, to begin to see the different kinds of microbes, to understand what they do, has really been a very recent phenomenon that comes out of molecular biology and particularly recent genomics. But I guess, and this just to make my general point about Darwin and Darwinism, is that it just seems very curious that it still seems to be the case that even contemporary biology is somewhat tempted to validate itself by appeal to Darwin's approval. And I mean, sometimes I think it's just as God appears on both sides in almost every war, Darwin tends to appear on both sides of most science biological debates. And I, just to get some sense of how odd this is, I mean, it would be very strange if people started describing physics as Newtonism. And it was we certainly don't imagine that we're going to validate ideas in physics by appeal to to kind of obscure statements in Newton's writings. So finally, just to make clear, I'm not coming to bury Darwin, I'm even coming to praise him. Darwin, of course, was an inspirational scientist. And I think, of course, the reason that he has such an important place in our imagination is that he was crucial in providing us with a naturalistic theory of the origins of life and human origins, and the first one that really carried conviction. But of course, none of that makes him a contemporary authority on biology. So let me just give some senses of what, I guess at the risk of continuing to use this perhaps unfortunate term, Darwinism, I'll call revisionist Darwinism. And let me now just gesture to some of the major changes in biological knowledge that start to undermine the standard neo-Darwinist ideas. And most of these, I will say something about in what follows. So here's a topic that I've been recently very interested in, the question of whether we should still consider the tree of life a useful image for understanding biological diversity. And some of you may have seen this recent cover of the New Scientist magazine, where probably somewhat unfortunately I was quoted in this, which at least got me more visibility on creationist blogs than I would necessarily have wanted, where I made some somewhat dismissive remarks about the tree of life. And of course, as people on the other kind of blog said, this cover is going to appear in creationist PowerPoints for the next 20 years. Actually, it didn't really even, there was even an editorial that said that wasn't at all what they meant. Another area, and this is a very broad kind of area, is whether in fact natural selection is, at least as understood by neo-Darwinists, in any sense a sufficient way of understanding the causes of adaptation. And the book that I've put up cover of there is one, covers one particularly innovative and exciting way of thinking about other causes of, or contributors to evolution, not perhaps counter to natural selection, but going against a very standard idea of the sort of randomness of the variation which natural selection selects from. The topic that I'm going to say most about today is the sense in which our focus on natural selection has tended to lead us to be really insufficiently sensitive to the importance of cooperation in evolution. And I won't say anything about that now because I'm going to say a lot more in the next few minutes. And then finally, to end with what I suppose is the ultimate heresy in contemporary neo-Darwinian thought, I'll say something about the revival of Lamarckian ideas. As I'll explain, by Lamarckian, I don't mean exactly Lamarck's ideas any more than Darwinian necessarily means Darwin's ideas. And again, I'll come to that a bit later. But let me start off with the tree of life. Now, obviously, one must start talking about the tree of life this year with Darwin's picture of something that might possibly be construed as something like a tree of life. This leads to a kind of picture that probably all of us have seen from kind of secondary school onwards of little tree-like things like that. I must mention that the first 5/6 of the history of life is that sort of blob at the bottom. And some of you, I was very struck recently with a Guardian, some of you have seen those little posters they were putting out, and there was one called The History of Life, and that also started about 600 million years ago, which is to say the first 2.5 million years of evolution were left out, because I guess you can't draw nice pictures of microbes. But one of the themes to my thinking about this that will continue to be obvious is that I think one of our deficiencies in a lot of thought about biology is that we forget that nearly all living things are microbes, and for most of the history of life, those are the only things that were living. So that blob at the bottom is rather significant. Here's a picture of the blob. Oh, yeah, that's okay. Here's a picture of the blob. This is a kind of current view of microbial evolution. And the important thing here are the red lines. The black lines are a rough hypothesis about what the underlying tree looks like. The red lines show ways in which we currently believe that genes have been transferred from one microbe to another. So what we start to have is a tree, but contrary to the way we often think about the tree as branching, and once the branches are separated, they are separate for eternity, it turns out that genetic material, at least, is constantly shuffled around between organisms. And so we get, in a way, something that maybe looks more like the bottom picture here. This is a microbiologist for Doolittle's picture of how we should see the tree of life, at least for microbes, is the picture at the bottom. This phenomenon of genetic material moving between organisms is called lateral gene transfer, obviously by contrast to vertical gene transfer through the more familiar processes of reproduction that are celebrated in traditional trees. And my point is that this is known to be something that probably all microbes do some of, some microbes do lots and lots of. And so I think this is becoming more and more of a view among microbiologists that there is just no tree for this part of life. And this, as I would say again, dominant part of life. And just to get a sense of this, we often think of the tree in terms of species. And of course, that resonates with Darwin. But if we look at what counts as a species in microbes, it's something massively different from what we think of as a tree in, as a species, I'm sorry, in kind of big, like I say, charismatic eukaryotes. So the E. coli, the most familiar microbial species, if you look at different strains of E. coli, they will have, across the whole range, about 40% of their genome in common. The rest of the bits of genetic material that are stuck onto this sort of platform amount to the other 60%. And if we now talk about the pangenome of E. coli, that's all the genes that you might find in some E. coli or other, and that's about four times the size of the genome of any particular strain of E. coli. Now, on that criterion, you know, we would not only be of the same species as other animals, but we'd be the same species as trees and fungi. And this is just one species. So something, I think, has gone astray in perhaps trying to transpose this picture we have of species mostly derived from big charismatic organisms to microbes. There's a more radical view which goes beyond microbes and recognizes the fact that actually all of us live in a great wash of DNA. Most of this carried by viruses and things like viruses. And the thought that actually lateral transfer may be really fundamental to evolution. What I sometimes call about evolution by merger. It's certainly known that viral remains are substantial components of the genomes of eukaryotic organisms like ourselves, plants, fungi. And in fact, recent bits of viral insertion may be passed from one organism to another because the genome can then still make the virus. So I think it's entirely possible that the notion of trees is becoming unhelpful or at least misleading sometimes, even for complex organisms like ourselves. The point being that the tree leads us to think that we can explain the properties of the thing by looking at how properties are passed down from branch to branch to smaller branches. But if in fact one of the fundamental processes is picking up bits of stuff from other organisms, then at least we're missing out some part of evolution by focusing exclusively on the vertical transmission of important characteristics. Let's just say a little bit more about viruses because they tend to be even less widely discussed than microbes. Just to get some idea of how common these things are, there are a lot of them. If you line them up, they'd go a long way. And they're everywhere, and they're in every organism. There are trillions of them in our bodies, and so on. Now, they don't just hang around in the bodies. They're also, a lot of the genome is composed of recognizably viral insertions. The first thing I say, when I say 10% of the genome is composed of potentially functional, most scientists would not think it's likely that 10% are actually functional in the sense of producing coding for proteins. But nevertheless, they are there. We think all the time that more and more of the genome is doing something. So they could well be important. And in fact, that 10% there, I'm talking about bits of sequence that look as if they could in principle be coding sequence. But about half of the whole genome is bits and pieces and remains of viral insertions. And there's another point which I think is more subtle, but ultimately perhaps more important. Viruses have an ability to explore genetic space which is incomparably greater than you or I or a tree or anything like this. Off the top of my head, more than 20 orders of magnitude more. There are 10 to the 31 of these things. Most of them are or very many of them, are destroying a cell every day and producing a few thousand copies. And the sort of the rate at which they are exploring possibilities of coding sequence is so enormous that it starts to seem quite plausible that novel sequence actually typically arises here rather than in the painfully slow reproductive processes that we're more familiar with. And as kind of support for that, most of the genes, or what we call genes, in viruses are not found so far anywhere in larger, more complex organisms. So there is this massive reserve of genetic possibility being created all the time. And so I think the impact of this, and again, the impact that lies quite outside the traditional branching pattern that we think of in the tree of life, is potentially almost unlimited. There's one sense in which I haven't talked about this, but we would sadly, I guess, be now going, the human population would currently be undergoing a massive bottleneck with the HIV virus if we were not smart enough to control this. And probably at the end of that, we would have a much smaller population with a modified genome, including genetic possibilities that enabled us to live with the HIV virus. This may well have been a very important factor in evolution. But a second point, and I guess I've already intimated this, we tend to think of viruses as just nasty things that we want to try and avoid, and of course some of them are, but I think we're increasingly realizing that they are actually functional parts of complex biological systems, and the significance of this will become more obvious in a moment. And the third point is that a certain class of viruses are fully understood as functioning by dumping their genes into the genomes of other organisms. And we don't know, we know this happens all the time. We don't know a lot about how much of this stays there, but as I said, 50% of the human genome seems to have come from this kind of sources. So this is probably pretty important. Missing a word. The word placenta should have come under the evolution of the. And this is just an example of one case that is now recognized to be a case of a major evolutionary change that came about through the insertion of protein coding sequences from viruses. And in particular, there's a layer that is of tissue that's fundamental in maintaining the barrier between the fetus and the mother that is derived from a virally introduced protein, or at least so it has been very credibly argued. Right. So what I want to suggest that maybe a broader concept that one might look at lateral gene transfer under is endosymbiosis. That's by endosymbiosis, I mean essentially evolution by merger or evolution by cooperation. Now, strictly endosymbiosis is the absorption by one organism of another so that they become a joint organism. It seems to me that one can look at lateral gene transfer, so one looks at it slightly more broadly as just the incorporation of a part of another organism into an organism as an evolutionary change. Then one can look at lateral gene transfer as, broadly speaking, part of this kind of phenomenon. So, as I've said, viruses continue to do this in eukaryotes and complex organisms. Now, one thing that, this is the phenomenon that made endosymbiosis famous among biologists, was the idea that this was actually the origin of complex modern cells many billions of years ago, I wouldn't worry too much about the details of that picture because it's controversial in detail, but it's very widely believed that the cells that make up our body are the result of the merger of two simpler cells and the capture of a third kind of cell, the mitochondria, that power the energy requirements of our cells. So this would be a very extreme case and is, I say, the most classic case of endosymbiosis. But the basic idea is that major evolutionary innovation comes about not through evolution within a lineage down the branch of a tree, but through things getting together and working better as a whole than they did as individual parts. Now, let me then, and I hope there's a smooth enough transition, look at this from a slightly different perspective and bring in this idea of cooperation. As I've said, generally the idea of natural selection has led us to focus almost exclusively on competition in thinking about evolution, and has I think tended to lead us to underplay the importance of cooperation. But the fact of the matter is, and I will explain this much more, cooperation is absolutely fundamental to what living things do. And there's a whole range of levels of cooperation. One extreme is endosymbiosis, complete merger. The other is simply ecological interdependence. And I would suggest there's just a spectrum from one end to the other with all kinds of intermediate cases. What I want to just generally suggests is that forming parts of cooperative wholes is really what biological lineages most fundamentally do. And I think looking at that idea may help to redress the overemphasis on competition. I'm of course not suggesting that competition isn't important, I'm just suggesting it's maybe one side of a coin and the other is cooperation. Now, let me give some illustrations of this. Now, basically, if you look at neo-Darwinian discussions of cooperation, this is the case that is discussed. Almost all cooperation is understood in terms of what is called Hamilton's rule, in terms of what maybe is more familiar as kin selection. All Hamilton's rule says is things cooperate if the benefit to the organism with which they're it's usually described as altruism. So things do something nice to another organism if the benefit they convey, factored in by the relatedness, so the relatedness meaning 50% to offspring in sexual organisms, 12.5% to your first, second cousin, so on, is greater than the cost to you. And here we have the classic examples of cooperation, the social insects and rather similar, one fascinating case of somewhat similar social mammals, the naked mole rats on the bottom right there, termites, and bees. And the very interesting insights into this particular evolutionary trajectory have indeed been provided by theories of kin selection. For example, it appears that this particular kind of cooperative sociality seems to depend on very concentrated reproduction in actually typically just two reproductive organisms, the queen bee and the king bee, more or less. Mole rats more or less do the same thing. So that's very nice, and there's a triumph for neo-Darwinism. But there's a fascinating recent development in ants, relatives of bees, which seems much more problematic. And this, I don't know, I actually picked up this story recently driving into work. And the story was that we were going to very soon have 10 times as many ants in our gardens because ants had done a very cool thing and they'd learned to cooperate with one another across colonies. And this comes, so I guess these things are in danger of coming across the channel. The British gardens for British ants, we should say. But as things are, at the moment when these things, which actually came from Argentina before they went off to the Costa Brava, are really remarkable. And as the picture shows, this species of ants is essentially the colonies have stopped fighting one another. And so for this chain of 3,500 miles, these ants are cooperating with one another, with a little anomalous bit in the Catalans where there's a super colony of cooperating ones that don't cooperate with the rest. And this is not so easy to explain on the basis of Hamilton's law, because these are basically unrelated colonies. And there was an assumption at first that they were perhaps genetically very similar, and that appears not to be the case. So here we have, but of course the thing to focus on is this was a very good idea, at least if this report was correct in saying we were going to have 10 times as many ants in our garden. Not good for us, but very good for the ants. And obviously it makes sense to think that not beating up on the next colony would be good for ants. And of course, we just a little reference to humans, of course, we do things like this. These groups of people killing one another on each side are not closely related, but they've decided to cooperate, unfortunately, in killing another colony. This is generally thought to be require some theory of cultural evolution to explain it, and that actually is something that Darwin did have some very good ideas about. Okay, this is, I think is very interesting, but actually what I'm really more interested in is the fact that cooperative systems typically are, that life typically consists of cooperative systems that are not actually made up of the same kinds of organisms at all. So this is what I call multigenomic cooperative systems. And the basic point I want to make here is that if you look at what a functional biological whole consists of, it is almost invariably a wide variety of different kinds of cells from different kinds of organisms cooperating together to find an interacting whole. Now, let me start off with, I guess, because I like to start at the bottom with the microbes. Microbes typically live in complex, multi-kind colonies. There's about 500 different kinds of microbes make up the dental plaque that we all carry about on our teeth. And this is a very functional, very responsive kind of organism. If you change your diet, you'll get different colonies of bacteria on your teeth. Colonies of bacteria are everywhere. Everywhere you've got a slippery surface, you'll find colonies of bacteria. And this example is from Yellowstone Park, where they're living in highly chemical, toxic environments, or toxic for us, not for them. Because microbial communities, they get together the right players, and they can live just about anywhere. Microbes also cooperate fundamentally with what I like to call macrobes, because it seems so strange we don't have a word for for this tiny minority of things that aren't microbes. So some sort of gross level examples that are very fascinating. This thing, the Pompeii worm, is the most heat tolerant multicelled organism known on Earth. And the way that it does that appears to be having this nice fleece, which is essentially made up of heat-tolerant bacteria that enable its unusual lifestyle. Different example, here is a deep-sea octopus. The deep-sea octopus has, because it lives in the deep sea, has not much use for its suckers, and so its suckers no longer suck, but actually are colonized by bioluminescent bacteria that help it to see in the dark, probably attract prey to it. So it's a nice little cooperative setup. But I'm really more interested in or at least I think what's even more fundamental, thinking about maybe more familiar organisms. And I like to think about cows, maybe just because they're my neighbours, but because I think they give one can, in a sense, a wholly different perspective on what's going on. Now, really, it seems to me what a cow is they don't really do much but process grass. Now, how do they process grass? Well, actually, they have vats full of microbes that process grass and manage to metabolize this not terribly promising chemical. Now, if you start to look at it from the microbes' point of view, the microbes tend to have two problems. The first problem is that this is a sequential process, and ideally you'd have one bunch of microbes doing the first stage and another doing the second and have several stages. The other problem is that microbes aren't that good at getting around or in a systematic, directed way. So when they've eaten a chunk of grass, then they're stuck there with nothing more to eat. So what's the solution? Well, you want a series of vats and a sort of simple locomotion system. There you have it. There's a cow, a series of microbial vats hooked together with a primitive sort of transport system to carry it to the next piece of grass. Now, I mean, of course, joking apart, the point is that this is not just one line of cells derived from a cow embryo. This is a very complex multi-species system, and that's what interacts with the rest of the world. And of course, the same is true for us. We are similarly multi-species cooperative communities. And just some points that probably many of you are familiar with, that the human body is most of the cells in the human body are microbes. Most of them live in our gut, but basically on the surface of our skin, our other orifices. And these are cooperative entities on the whole. And indeed, it's increasingly clear that we would not live without them. If we were totally sterile organisms, I, with all their microbes killed, do very poorly and generally don't do at all. And indeed, most of the genes in the human body live in these microbes. And there's a major project now, the Human Microbiome Project, of trying to get a sense of what these organisms are, what they do, how they affect development, physiology, immunity, nutrition, and so on. We don't understand this very well, but it's a rapidly advancing field. And I, just in case there are botanists in the room, plants in this are in some ways certainly equally fascinating. The root systems of plants are essentially the sites for massively complex microbial communities. There are fungi that live inside the roots and send out their mycelia into the surrounding soil. And the reference here is to an article that was presenting some evidence that these fungal networks that are involved in plant nutrition actually exchange nutrients and exchange them even between unrelated plants. Now, of course, we actually knew that was true, but we tended to call the plants that we knew it was true of parasitic plants, which, of course, we knew lived off the roots of other plants. But there seems to be some evidence that there's quite general exchange of nutrients through these fungal mycelial networks underground. So, and here I'm just really repeating, I think that these kinds of mutualistic relations of mutual cooperation, really form a spectrum to complete endosymbiosis. And just one area that I'd say more about if I had more time, there are extraordinarily intimate relations between insects and microbes. One extreme, there are the Buchnera, which live in aphids, and are essentially fully absorbed endosymbiotic organisms. They've lost a lot of the genes that they need to survive as free living organisms, but they produce a lot products that are essential for the aphids. Wolbachia are bacteria that live in perhaps half of all insect species, and it's much less clear how mutualistic this is, but it's increasingly clear that they provide some benefits for their hosts. What's particularly fascinating and may not be a benefit is the wall back here often take over aspects of the reproductive system and, for example, determine the sex of the insects that they live in, which may or may not be good for the hosts. Okay. Now, actually, I want to the radical claim that I would make from all this is that we actually need to reconceive what we think of as constituting a living thing. And partly based on this very vertical view of life as, you know, trees and actually even the organism itself or the multicelled organism being sort of tree-like, starting out from a sort of root in the embryo and branching out into the different kinds of cells, when we move away to a more cooperative view, we should see that actually a living thing is a cooperative arrangement between bits of lots of different lineages. And that's really all I've just been saying with these various examples. So there are, you know, the bacterial lineages of the things in my guts, and there's the lineage of human cells, but all these different lineages come together to form the functional whole. And my last point on this slide, I think that one can usefully think of this as introducing a kind of pluralism in which one shouldn't think of any particular biological entity as necessarily being part of one particular organism. Certainly one can see this hierarchically. There may be perspectives from which one would want to see, you know, even a single bacterium in my gut as an entity, but then there are also complex communities that live on the surface of my gut, and then there's me, and then perhaps there are higher level things composed of me and other things like other people. Now, probably the most contentious topic I want to talk about is to suggest that we need to reconsider the kind of real bugbear of Darwinism, Lamarckianism. The first thing to say is that when I say Lamarckianism, and I did mention this at the outset, I really don't mean to have anything to do with poor old Lamarck. Actually, probably I'm saying that more negatively because a lot of the things that he thought don't seem very credible now. But for better or worse, Lamarckianism has come to mean something like inheritance of acquired characteristics, of characteristics that developed as the organism interacted with the environment. And as I say, I think it's in almost a defining position of neo-Darwinism that we are not very happy with the thought of Lamarckianism in any sense. I'm not going to defend it with massive conviction, but I just want to suggest that the standard arguments that are used against it are quite uncompelling. We should be open-minded, and indeed there are good reasons for thinking at least some Lamarckian processes might be important in evolution. Now, why are neo-Darwinians so hostile to become Lamarckism, same thing as Lamarckianism? And I think the idea is there is an assumption that only genes are inherited. The only thing that an organism gets essentially when it starts out in life is a bunch of genes. Now, obviously, that's not strictly true. I mean, organisms start at least with a cell, but then the idea is that, you know, the other stuff in the cell is just kind of machinery for reading the genes or something like that. And I just want to say that I think we know very well that this is not actually correct. I mentioned cultural evolution. I'm not going to spend time on that this evening, but this is a very well-studied process, and certainly there are some forms of cultural evolution. Now, as a sort of, maybe almost aside, a lot of neo-Darwinian biologists will say, well, yes, we understand, of course we recognize that there's cultural evolution, but that's not really evolution. Now, it seems to me this is just a dogma at work. It seems to me evolution is about changes in the way organisms are. if one generation of organisms is different from the preceding generation of organisms, then some evolution has taken place. Now, it seems to me that that's clearly something that happens with cultural evolution, and it's just a kind of insistence on making some sort of semantic legislation that we don't call that evolution. There's also, and I mentioned cytological inheritance. So I mentioned that we all know that it isn't really just genes that are inherited. A whole cell is passed on from one organism to its offspring. Now, of course, then the question is, as I say, whether that constitutes more than just a bit of machinery. Well, I think the answer is increasingly clear that it includes much more. And part of the reason it does is this last thing that I mentioned, epigenetic inheritance, because, and I guess I should explain what that is. The point is that cytological inheritance, the inheritance of the contents of the cell apart from the genome, have effects on the genome, which are what have called epigenetic or epigenomic. So let me just quickly say what this is. And this is a one of the more rapidly developing areas of molecular biology, and again is one which I think is very fundamentally changing the way we come to think about living processes. Now, you can start thinking about this with this very simple question: why do cells in your body, which all, we suppose, have the same genome, do different things? Why are some cells liver cells, some brain cells, so on? Well, part of the answer, maybe most of the answer, lies within this area of epigenetics, i.e., that the genome is modified by its environment, immediately by its cellular environment, in ways that that determine which bits of the genome actually are active, which bits are being transcribed, what protein or what RNA sequences are being transcribed and turned into proteins, and so on. And this is this little picture of the most familiar part of epigenetics, which is the methylation of particular genes in the genome, which is generally thought to block transcription of that bit of the gene. Now, as everything, nothing is simple in biology, and I just read a couple of months ago some discussion of methylation enhancing transcription. But that's just to make life more complicated. But these modifications, and there's several different kinds of modifications that we currently understand, of the genome, have a great deal to do with what particular cells do. And these and cytological inheritance of the cell, certainly seems likely to have effects on how the cell actually behaves. So that the moral of this is that we're inclined to be told that a genome is a sequence of, you know, these C's, A's, G's, and T's. But actually, a genome is something much more complicated that includes all kinds of additional editing and annotation by the chemistry of the cell that tells it actually what to do with this sequence data. And just to give a sense of the sorts of things that people are finding out about epigenetics, I said that the effects, the epigenetic influences on the genome are mediated in the first instance by the cellular environment. But what is actually much more fascinating is that epigenetic effects can appear to respond to much more gross, large-scale environmental influences. And what happens to the organism, its experiences in the world, can affect methylation. And I'm not quite sure. Yes, didn't come up in quite the right order. And here is a classic example, and points to some quite, in a way, quite unexpected mechanisms of inheritance in evolution. And this example is, there's a rat at the bottom, which is, I believe, giving high-quality maternal care to the little baby rats. Now, it appears that giving high-quality maternal care brings about epigenetic changes in the brains of growing rats, and here's a little detail which I won't go into on the right of what seems to be the actual molecular mechanism of this, such that effectively, if a rat is given proper maternal care, it will be a nice, friendly, not too nervous kind of rat, and it will be disposed to give good quality maternal care to its offsprings, if it's a lady rat. And here we have a full mechanism of inheritance of a characteristic of the organism. It just passes through the external environment, through the behavior of the animals, through the chemistry of the cells and the brain, and so on. So I guess the moral of this is only that we need to be very clear that there may be a lot of mechanisms of inheritance that we don't fully understand yet. And what's more, this one looks alarmingly Lamarckian, as if the response of the rat to the environment is at least is mediated by the adaptive response to the environment. And I guess I should explain further. The point is that if in a situation in which the things are generally good and the mothers have time to take care of their babies and the world isn't too frightening, this may be a better idea, investing all this maternal care, than if things are really bad and you might want your babies to be nervous and not spend too much time licking their pups. And I guess the thought is, if this is part of a kind of set of Lamarckian mechanisms, surely it would not be very surprising if Darwinian evolution even had evolved Lamarckian mechanisms of this sort, had evolved the ability of the organism to respond to the environment in ways that were adaptive. I mean, we know that organisms respond in adaptive ways to the environment. It's just that we have a kind of, almost dogmatic commitment, but that can't be evolutionary. And I think that's just dogmatic. So, finally, let me just conclude with a few remarks on the evolution of human nature. So what, if anything, does all this tell us about human nature? I just want to say something quite strongly negative. We really don't know nearly as much as we sometimes like to think about how evolution works. And what I'm trying to point to mainly in this talk is the areas in which our understanding is expanding rapidly, but as is typically the way with rapidly expanding understandings, is pointing to an awful lot of things that we only partly understand. In particular, I think we clearly don't know enough about evolution to use it what I would call predictively as opposed to explanatory. What I mean by that is I think that a lot of writing on human evolution tends to take the form of life in our ancestral environment was like this. It would have been a good idea for our ancestors to do that, and so they probably did, and so that's at least we should spend our time trying to validate that kind of a hypothesis. Now, I think that this is something that goes far beyond what we know about evolution, and indeed I suspect it's something that in principle isn't going to work, that there's too much contingency in the evolutionary process for it to be plausible that we can really use reflections on past history to make inferences about how we must be. And there's a crucial point also here which people sometimes, I think, don't adequately realize about human evolution, that the really at least the most compelling way of giving arguments about what organisms should be like given evolution is comparative. It's by looking at a range of organisms that are closely related. And the fact is that in terms of studying human behavior, we have no useful evolutionary relatives. We're interested in, when we talk about the evolution of human behavior, as to the kinds of distinctively human behaviors that differentiate us from our closest relatives. And our closest relatives separated from us 5-6 billion years ago, million years ago. We've wiped out our close relatives, it appears. So we can't use this. So we should recognize that we really don't have the main way available for making kind of plausible inferences about what we should be like given the evolutionary process. And I guess this leads me to a topic I've probably I've said a lot about in the past, and I'll be very quick with. But it seems to me that that evolutionary psychology, I mean this in the sense, the sort of capitalized sense that its proponents have taken on, a particular school of trying to talk about the evolution of human psychology, seems to me to commit all the sins that I was intimating in my last, the last few minutes. Evolutionary psychology, most of you probably know, is an idea that we understand human psychology essentially by looking at a particular period of history, the Pleistocene, or sort of later Stone Age, and figuring out what would have been the best way for humans to have been reproductively successful in that time. Now, there are lots of things you can say about that. For example, people often like to say that, contrary to a common assumption, probably this was a very diverse period and things changed all the time. But I want to just focus on one thing, that the crucial to this argument is the suggestion that evolution is just too slow to create significant novelties without, hundreds of thousands or millions of years. This, it seems to me, is entirely based on this neo-Darwinian model that's been in the background of this talk, that sees evolution as consisting in gradual spread of selectively advantaged genetic variations. Now, the various things that I've been saying about evolution through cooperation, cultural evolution, which I've only mentioned very briefly, possibility of epigenetic modes of evolution, seem to me to suggest we have no good grounds for making this kind of assumption about the potential rate of evolution. And so I'm likely to go along. I was like Stephen Rose's likes to characterize this view as the Flintstone school of human evolution, which essentially saying that this is basically just transferring what we think humans are like onto people who were living a million years ago. Okay, so there's an alternative view, and this is just coming to the end. We might look and say, if we actually look at history for the last 10 or 20,000 years, we can see there has been massive evolution of humans. And recall here what I said about evolution, not being tied to a theory, but just meaning change in the nature of the organisms, the way the organisms in this case behave. And this should be, we should take this as evidence that there are much faster processes of evolution than are conceived of in neo-Darwinism. And I really just want to say there should be nothing at all shocking about this. Cultural evolution, I've said, is familiar and well studied, and there are other processes which are not fully understood, but which certainly should lead us to suppose that we have no reason to assume that we couldn't have changed quite radically as a species in relatively short periods of time. So, to conclude, there's been certainly quite a bit of speculative material in this talk, and I guess I'm licensed as a philosopher to be a bit speculative, but I think there's something that is not speculative at all, and that is that biology has moved a very long way. Indeed, I'd like to say it's moved a very long way in the last few decades, and Darwin is part of its history. not its present. And I guess I just want to, the very last thing I want to say is, I think that there is more than just an anomaly of the way we think about scientific history going on here. That somehow the way we kind of almost sacralize Darwinism is sometimes lends support to some ideas that are not only bad science, but flat out bad. And I think evolutionary psychology, to my mind, is not just the application of outdated evolutionary ideas, which claim to tell us what we're like, but it often tells us things that we should not, it would be better not to believe we were like, particularly when we have no reason to think that what they tell us is true. And with that, I thank you very much for your attention.
Sorry, I was distracted. Well, the heroes of some of our lectures this series have been fish and frogs and sea elephants and cactuses and things like that. I think the heroes of this lecture are microbes. If you can have 10 to the power 31 heroes in the plot, I'm not quite sure what happens. But one thing I do go away convinced with is that I thought I had a purpose in life, and now I know it. I'm a sort of vegetable garden and public transport system for an awful lot of microbes. I suppose the greatest tribute you can make to the contribution of Darwin to science is to show that how much his theories of natural selection have continued to evolve. And Professor Dupré's given us a wonderful account of the shifting emphasis in this evolution, with more on mergers, more emphasis on mergers and less on sex, more emphasis on cooperation and less on competition, hierarchies of cooperation of which we are so much a part, more emphasis on non-genetic evolution, which I have to say I found completely fascinating. I was long ago told that the real purpose of universities and of intellectual activities to broaden the brown boundaries of ignorance, to increase the subtlety of our view of what we don't understand. And tonight's lecture has done that wonderfully. In a sense, Darwinism is dead, but his influence as a scientist has rarely been so strong. So thank you very much indeed for that talk.